나자이다나브라마니다나야야데이다고다나시바사디
The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on October 31st, 1986 at New Taliban Farm in Carrier, Mississippi. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 9, Text 43.
Auditorium in the top mall of the city. There's not so many malls in there. It's like in the center of it, they have a big auditorium, and there are over 1,000 people were there, all very high. As a result, people were very impressed by the Vedic wedding ceremony. They said, oh, this is very spiritual. Because we explained at each point what are the different obligations, a husband and wife, what are the concepts behind it, law of karma, reincarnation, different things that people could appreciate. So within the Vedic culture, there's so many rules and regulations or so many different rituals that are there, whether garbhodan samskara or marriage. Well, marriage, garbhodan samskara, then after 3 months of pregnancy, 4, 6, or 8 months of pregnancy, birth, all these different things, all meant for purifying the family situation, for raising Krishna conscious children. When they start Gurukul, there's also a ceremony. This actual special ceremony when Lord Chaitanya first is going to start his studies, then the father does the sacrifice, prays to Vishnu, and personally puts the pen in his hand officially for the first time and has him write the name of Krishna. Like this, there's a whole ceremony when someone formally starts studying in the Gurukul. There's so many ceremonies which are meant to get the blessing of Krishna on the children and to purify the whole situation. So the people in the West, they're totally amazed by, actually we use these as various preaching programs, giving the first grains. Or it's very interesting to the people, especially if they're a little pious, to see that how a culture is so filled with spiritual consciousness. So in contrast, of course, we have a material situation where everyone's making plans to be happy. Everyone's making plans to be happy. What's very interesting was recently in South America, they had a thing broadcasted in television where they're interviewing different Americans, and each were giving their opinion about how the world should be better and this and that, all the big, big plans. Then at the end, they ask, are you happy? Not one said yes. No. Don't be abstract. Happiness. We'll be happy in the future. So, this is the thing. In this material world, if we're very pragmatic, it's a dukkhalayam. There's bound to be suffering. The real happiness in the material world doesn't come from sense gratification, because sense gratification produces suffering. So whatever sense gratification we enjoy on the one hand, we are going to suffer some other kind of inconvenience on the other hand. So there's no perfect situation here in the material world. And the best you can do is a sign of balance sense gratification. But that's not ultimately satisfying, so nobody wants to balance. Unless you have spiritual life, unless there's Krishna consciousness, sense gratification itself, whether balanced or whether in excess, it doesn't produce satisfaction. Of course, those in the mode of goodness, the brahmanas who have a little, a very balanced life, they actually become kind of peaceful in a material sense, so they feel self-complacent. So sometimes the people who are leading a little natural life, a little pure life, they feel a little bit of relief from a lot of the excessive sufferings that one gets in the material world by acting excessively, by acting irregularly. But that little bit of peace that they get is in itself that's not the ultimate objective either, because that is also not pure happiness. Simply it's a reduction of the miseries that people are getting because of previously being too much in the mode of ignorance or passion. What is really needed is a positive spiritual happiness, and that comes from practicing Krishna consciousness. So Prahlad Maharaj, he can see this lack in society. The people are making so many plans, they're going ahead very enthusiastically, but actually that they're foolish because ultimately nothing is going to produce that real happiness that they're looking for. That is produced by being Krishna conscious. Recently, in the October issue of the Omni magazine, they produced a whole series of articles on longevity, how to make the body live longer. And they're spending millions and millions of dollars trying to extend the life, trying to find out which hormones cause the body to age and which lack of hormones will start. So they have worked out that if they just get another $30, $40, $50 million, then they're going to be able to extend possibly maybe the body of the life by taking various injections and things by 50%. In other words, if you're 65 years old, you'll look like you're 40. And if you're 100 years old, you look like you're 65 and so on. Of course, eventually you're going to have to die anyway. Of course, then there's a few of the people that they say, well, it doesn't look like we're going to have a breakthrough before I die. So they're investing in the new techniques of freezing the body so that they can have hibernation. So as soon as they figure out what chemicals to push into the body, then they can be rethought out and cured from their disease. Like this, they're so materialists, they're making so many plans, spending so much money, trying to figure out how to make the body live a little longer, how to extend the life. But if actually but then even there, they admitted that, like, the Spanish people are looking in Florida for the fountain of youth because they had seen different drawings which showed people getting old, like in the Indian Aztecs or whatever, showing them getting old and dipping into some kind of water and coming out and being young. So they took it to mean there's a fountain of youth. They're looking everywhere. But now, after studying it, some of the other scientists, after studying Indian philosophy, they say this simply is symbolic for reincarnation. You get old, you die, you take a new birth, you get a new young body, going in the ocean of birth and death. You dip in and come out again. It's simply that at that time, and they also found that the Aztecs' language is non-different from the language of Bangalore in South India, the Karnada language, and that they have Vishnu deities, and that the king, the queen, the king had Tila of the Aztec king in Mexico, and the queen had a little dot on her forehead. And like they found so many things now that they recently found a Vishnu deity in Mexico, and the Mexican government was so embarrassed that their culture is coming from India that they donated the deity to India so they wouldn't have to keep it in their museum and explain it. And so the Indian ambassador came over, or whatever, minister, and took it back to India. But like this way, people are really avoiding the fact that Indian culture is the original culture of our world. The Indian culture is actually providing us. We should look to our roots. You hear all the time, roots, 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 look to your roots, and we go into the jungles and try to find where we came from. But actually, the whole civilization is coming from India. The reason I took Atmatatra Prabhu to the Epcot to show him that, so we get an idea, because we want to make a Chaitanya world in Mayapur. And of course, they said, well, this is really boring. I was showing them how they keep showing the history of the world, and they show how there were cavemen, and then from cavemen it came Egypt. And from Egypt came Europe, and from Europe came America. And America is like that's it, you know, that's the top. So, but you know, how they just go from the cavemen to Egypt. And they show how the Egyptians or the Arabian culture gave the number system to the world. Arabian number system. But in the book which I gave Yogendra Prabhu on Vedic arithmetic and mathematics. It mentions, and I actually asked when I was in the Middle East, that there it mentions that in Arabia, their number system they call the Hindu number system, because it was brought from India by pundits to the old sheikhs in the desert there, who were milking their camels and eating the dates and things. It was, and they had some pearls in Arabia and the Persian Gulf. That's why they became a trade was between Persia and India. So these pundits came there and taught them the number system, because before in Europe, in the Roman number system, there was no zero. Zero didn't exist. So it's very hard to make complex mathematical calculations without zero. The zero concept, the Maya bodies love this, the zero concept came from India. Part of our Vedic. But the idea of zeros and the decimal system, all this is from India. That's why we have lakhs, crores, Arabs. These are all decimal system. So everyone's proud that we are from Arabia, from Egypt, but actually, this is all like how, it seems to me almost to be cheating, that somehow they're just purposely avoiding a very obvious fact that India is the origin of their culture of this world. Now, the language etymologists, they always say that this is the Latin Aryan, or this is the Slavic Aryan, because they say that language, Sanskrit, is the mother tongue of all the Latin languages and even all the Germanic. So they can't avoid that if the language is coming from the Sanskrit, then why not the culture? Why not look back to this original culture and see what they, now we've degenerated due to the various passings of time. Actually, the people, they feel, oh, these are Hare Krishnas or something. They don't know. We are their roots. We are their roots. The Indian culture or the Vedic culture is the root. They shouldn't feel alienated. They've been alienated by purposeful fudging of the propaganda that's been presented to them. So that they never think India is like something, well, yeah, really far out there, something, you know, starving people. They think, what is the connection between the West and Egypt? Egypt was simply a transit point of the culture coming from India to Europe. In fact, I don't even know how much relation it has at all, except that Egyptian culture also came from India, because they worshipped Ra, the sun. They worshipped different demigods, which can also be traced back to Indian culture. So, from that point of view, people could learn something by what is the ancient culture. But in any case, Prahlad Maharaj's point is that past, present, and future, there have always been these big plans to enjoy in the material world. But these plans, unfortunately, are failures. They don't work. So why don't we see what will work? And he's presenting, this is what works if you're Krishna conscious. This works. This is actually what makes people happy, because we're a combination of matter and spirit. If we neglect the soul simply by making material adjustments, no matter how many material adjustments we make, we won't be happy. So we have to take this desire or this idea, this hope within us. What is the one obstacle that's keeping us from being fully Krishna conscious is we harbor a hope that maybe somewhere, somehow, some way, in this material world, we can be happy by sense gratification. And that is the Maya. That is the illusion. That is the enjoying attitude. So then, when we get some opportunity to enjoy, we think, now, this is the way, this is the chance. And then, instead of taking shelter of Krishna, we try to take shelter of sense gratification. But we should thoroughly eradicate this last bastion of illusion and just take it completely out of our consciousness, that there is any hope, there's any way to achieve real peace or happiness in the material world except for Krishna consciousness. It is hopeless. By Krishna's own definition, it is dukkhalaya, it is asaswatam. It is a place of suffering, it is temporary. That means that no matter how hard you try to get happiness, there are going to be suffering. No matter how hard you try to make a permanent arrangement, it's going to be finished. Whether they extend their life by 20% or 50% or whatever, there's going to be complications. Anyway, they're going to die sooner or later. So, there's no real solution materially. The solution is given by Krishna, given by great souls like Prahlad Maharaj, is live a natural, balanced material life directed towards the aim of satisfying Krishna, towards devotional service. That is the best use of the body. Without the Krishna conscious touch, there's no real solution. I was once invited to speak by the Ford Institute of Development in Kathmandu, the capital of the only Hindu kingdom in the world, Nepal, on religion and science and development. This is an unusual topic, but their point that different science, I was the keynote speaker, but there are other people who are giving their introductions, and so it was a formal seminar. And at that time, they said that we've been doing a lot of in development, we've spent millions of dollars, but we find that in spite of that, the real material development or happiness of the people that we wanted hasn't increased. Maybe they had a mud house, some places they have a wood house, or they had a wood house or mud house, they have a brick house. We've been able to do some things like that, but the people are no happier. And sometimes even social problems increase. Instead of, we solve one superficial problem and we have another more real problem about character, morals, social injustice, and so on. So, somewhere we're failing. Somewhere our development work, despite of so much effort and investment, is not producing that which we want. So, what is wrong? Maybe religion has the answer. So then I was asked to speak on that. So even the materialists, the real intelligent intellectual materialists, they also understand that it's not working. Now, in Poland, despite so much socialistic propaganda and everything, being a Warsaw Bloc, that now they also have their own punk movement where the youth, they're fed up. They're tired of it. They don't want to hear any more about Marxism. They don't know. So they think, well, maybe the Western democracy. But in Western, we also have punks, and they're fried out with the Western way. So people are getting more and more disgusted. But because when we present, here's the positive alternative. This is the positive alternative. This is not destructive. This is not perversive. This is very constructive. This is very positive. This is very complete. But because the people are so fixed in their atheism and demoniac or materialistic ideas, or because they have a prejudice against anything which is not their culture or something like that, they mean it, no, no, it's the cult, it's the Hare Krishna, we don't want to, we got our own plans. And they just ignore it. Instead, they go ahead making all their plans, which are just going to create more and more problems. So what happens is it drives the youth to negative aspects, to negative alternatives, and they become more and more and more negative, and they become punks, or worse, they become terrorists, and they become drug addicts, and frustrated, and then the society says, what is the solution? What is the solution? We have to have a stronger police force, we have to, but then they say, we have to have heavy police force because 20% of Americans are taking marijuana, so we have to tighten up, but 20%. Of Americans are taking marijuana, then how much can you tighten up your police force if one of every five people is breaking that particular law? So they make these plans and you read it and you just think, what are these people doing? They're just totally an illusion. And unfortunately, you go to these big people and you try to explain something to them, they're so fixed in their materialistic plans, they're so attached to their little brainstorms, they don't want to hear it. So what did Prabhupada say? He said, therefore we are going to the people door to door, house to house, to convince them of this Krishna conscious movement. This is what Lord Chaitanya ordered even Nityananda and Haridas. Suno suno Nityananda suno Haridas sarvatra amaragya koroho prakash prati gore gore giya koro epika bolo Krishna bhajo Krishna koro Krishna shikha. Listen Haridas Thakur, listen Nityananda Prabhu, take my order and go to every house and beg the people to chant Hare Krishna, Bolo Krishna, Bojo Krishna, to worship Krishna, Koro Krishna Shikha, and to read Krishna's teachings. This was Lord Chaitanya's order, to get people to read Krishna's teachings. That's Prabhupada's books, Gita, Bhagavatam, Krishna's books. Bolo Krishna, to chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Hare. And bhajo Krishna, to worship Krishna in their home. This is our Krishna Perfection at Home Namhat Folk Program. But this was a particular order of Lord Chaitanya, specifically to go and meet the people, especially if we have a democratic country, but if the people can eventually be convinced of Krishna consciousness, then they'll elect leaders who are Krishna conscious. If they have leaders who are Krishna conscious, then maybe they'll add a little sense to all their plans. Right now it's the blind leading the blind. So, Prabhupada wanted that the people should see the Krishna conscious devotees as being so upright, straightforward, honest, that they'll naturally want to hear from them, that when their devotees speak to them, people will be very open and receptive. So, in this regard, of course, we have a long way to go. But gradually, by being open, by being conscientious, by cultivating those people who are favorable, and getting people who are in society to cultivate their friends and their known people, in this way, in a type of chain reaction, the preaching can expand. Our Navhat type of preaching, or where we try to get people to chant, but what are they going to do if they're sitting in their home? What are they going to, the point to do is get them to engage in preaching also. Get them. I have a disciple who's a quality control in a match factory, Swedish match factory in India. He's in charge of the quality control, and he has a personal program that from his salary, he gives every month 150 rupees. And he buys books. And he goes, and to each person in the factory, he gives them one book. And he asks them if they like, they can give a donation. But anyway, it's just a personal gift from him. If they like to give to his book fund, a little thing. So some, they give something. Whatever he gets, he again buys more books and gives out to more people. So in this way, he from 150 maybe gets 50% back, comes 225. So he said, even the communist union leaders of India, even when they saw he's going around, they said, hey, when am I going to get my book? And they got a book also. And everyone has become very favorable. So now he wants to know what are the next programs he can do, because he's almost covered all the 6,000 employees in his big factory. So, over a period of a couple of years. So, and there's other programs now that he's doing as well, but he's continuing on with the book distribution. So just one fired up folk member, he can also do so much preaching. But we have, it requires, just like we go on Sankirtan, we wonder how to distribute. And Krishna inspires with some idea, with some mantras, or some means, or some ways, or some ideas how to rescue Lakshmi, or how to do Sankirtan. Similarly, in every sphere, like Prabhupada wanted us to establish Varnashram in America. He wanted us to establish in the Western world the Varnashram system, to have Krishna consciousness reach the people, and to organize society in a more God-conscious manner. And actually we see that if you just study what are the problems of today, just like for instance they are concerned that so many high school teachers are having illicit sex with the high school students. In other words, instead of being a brahmanas and gurukul where they're strict and the teachers are strict and everyone's trained as a brahmana, because it's much a javana culture, so these teachers, to give good grades to their students, they're exploiting the students. And the parents are concerned what to do. But they're not able to do anything. But that's why in the Vedic culture, those who are the teachers are brahmanas. And brahmanas are by definition those in the mortal goodness who don't engage in illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, or meat eating. They lead a very simple life and a pure life. And they impart their knowledge to others. Well, the kshatriyas are other people. They're not the teachers in the gurukul. They're the kshatriyas of the people that run the government. And they sometimes get into a little drinking or a little thing because their politics and that is very heavy. And sometimes they get into a little bit of illicit activity, and there's some little scope for kshatriyas because of the nature and the danger and the risks that they take in a physical sense to perform their duties. So I guess the society is structured in such a way that if there were different laws for different occupations, if there were different, you could see that if varnashram were established not in a birth system but in a system of a type of social organization with an overall Krishna conscious or God conscious objective, that actually these various social problems that one by one are surfacing in the Western world, they could be much more easily controlled. Anyone who has any kind of a person to be certified as a teacher, they would have to go through certain, they have to be trained in that way, not simply academically, but morally and character-wise, they'd have to be certified. And if they don't live up to that standard, they're given certain, what is the reward for that? Well, a brahmana is given certain, if he had one world government, well, a brahmana is given certain facilities. He's able to travel. He doesn't need a visa anywhere he goes. Because he's a person who's given imparting knowledge to others. Well, for the other people, like Sudra, for them to travel, there's some restriction. Because their travel may be just to cause trouble. So, it's all, of course we're talking about 10,000 years from now, Krishna consciousness is still going to be in the world. That after some years, society may change drastically. It's not something that, well, seems even possible to happen immediately. But things can happen step by step. If we have the vision where we want to take society, no one else has any vision. They don't have any idea where society is going. They're just trying to keep the whole economic thing juggled, balancing. They're just somehow not trying to keep the things afloat. As far as figuring out where everything is going, you don't have the slightest idea. It's just going by accident. It's totally it's not in anyone's control. So Krishna conscious devotees have a concept, and if we keep on preaching that to people, if we become more and more conversant with the Varnashram concept, with the Krishna conscious concept, that we can gradually change society by Krishna's mercy. He has that power, without any doubt. We have to ourselves become thoroughly convinced that the goal of life is not sense gratification, the goal of life is Krishna consciousness. Then we can change other people. So long as we are harboring this idea that maybe there's a way that materially we can be happy, then we will not be able to easily convince other people to give up sense gratification. So the pure devotion means what? We give up our enjoying attitude. We don't no longer want to enjoy the material world. We want to engage the material energy in the service of Krishna. Ravana wanted the material energy to enjoy it. That is the difference. But Yudhisthira, he was given the material energy to engage in Krishna's service. So there's a difference between the attitude of the devotee and the attitude of the demoniac. So within us, of course, we are neither pure demon or pure devotee. We have mixtures of attitudes within us because of association with the material world. But those who are devotees have more divine quality and less demoniac. But we have to root out the demoniac quality. Lord Krishna explained in the Bhagavad Gita what are the Dhamanya qualities. We have to root those out. We have to take them. We have to purify ourselves from those by practically engaging in Krishna consciousness. And when we see something that's demonic, something that's materialistic, we take it away. Eventually, by the mercy of great devotees like Prahlad Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada, we can come up to that pure position where actually we're detached from the material desires. Where actually we are, just as Prahlad said, I'm happy anywhere I am. Why? Because I'm thinking always about Krishna. This is a perfectional platform, to always be thinking about Krishna, serving Krishna, talking about Krishna. And the material platform is we never talk about Krishna, we never serve Krishna, we simply want to serve our senses, we want to talk about everything else. We want to do everything else. This is a extreme. So in the devotional life, when we're living in an ashram, we learn to be silent. Now in India, of course, they have these Mona Babas. People that don't speak, they just sit there. And people think they're great sadhus, and then they write letters to everyone. You know, it's like, you want to say something, you write, you speak to them, and they answer you and giving you letters. The Prabhupada say, what is that? They're not speaking, but they're thinking and they're writing. Even for some years, they do this sometimes. They put on a show, they don't speak for a few years. So Prabhupada says, better they don't speak, because when they just speak nonsense. But that's not the real silence. Silence means to only talk about Krishna. So talking about Krishna doesn't mean that any devotional service we talk about, we don't talk about how Bhakti Bill is doing such a nice job repairing the tractor or something. Even though it's devotional service, because we're worshipping the deity, at that time we just chant Hare Krishna. How while we're cooking a nice tomato chutney for the deity, how some little baby's got a boil, and how the mother's got a new technique for squeezing out the pus or something. And this is it may be devotional service, it may be a time and place, but that's not the thing we discuss while we're cooking the tomato chutney for the deity. We think at that time that we're cooking this for the deity and it's to be offered. So there's a time and place for things, and we should do the thing, be Krishna conscious, and try to refine and control our mind so that we're actually silent. Silent means that we don't talk, but we talk about Krishna consciousness, which is appropriate for that time and place. Just like there may be devotional service, we don't talk about cleaning the bathrooms when we're eating prasadam. It's just not the proper thing to do. Although the tendency is always there, but it's not the proper thing. When you're talking to a neophyte person, you don't tell them all about how such and such senior devotee has had some difficulty, because what is it going to help? Some people always have difficulty in the material world. They try to be Krishna, whether junior or senior, sometimes it may happen. But you don't discuss these things with the neophyte devotees, because they're just trying to themselves figure out what is Krishna consciousness. And if they hear that some senior devotee has difficulty, then it sometimes bewilders them. And if you want to explain part, you got to explain the whole thing. And then they have to have enough brain to be able to digest it. They have to have enough philosophical basis. So, better not to enter into something unless you can completely give a proper explanation. So, like this, in silence or in controlling our mind, gradually we also become more and more conscientious of what things at what time will be pleasing to Krishna. And finally, the culmination of that is explaining the nectar of devotion about rasavash. That even certain topics, for instance, like the mood of Radha and Krishna and the mood of Yasoda and Krishna, are different. One is conjugal, one is vatsalya. So these don't mix. Conjugal and maternal or fraternal love does not mix together. So you can't mix, in other words, the mother is not ever, the pure paternal love is not mixed with any kind of conjugal. It's a different attitude, it's a totally different situation. And if somehow somebody mixes the two, then it becomes a rasabhas. So that is in a very high level of tasting transcendental mellows, which Lord Chaitanya, he had Sarup Damodar check all the books and literatures that were written to see there was no rasabhas. And then, of course, you know, that's something which eventually we hope to attain to, is be able to understand all these different subtleties between relationships of Krishna and his devotees. And then, but the same thing on a grosser level has its application in our daily activities, what we say, what is appropriate at a particular time and circumstance. So in the nectar, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says we have to become expert in Vaishnava etiquette. That Vaishnava etiquette is one of the things that a person needs to know before they can get love for Krishna. If we offend the Vaishnavas, someone may be a great manager, but in his management, if he offends Vaishnavas, then he may not get love for Krishna. So what is the advantage? So a person has to know how to manage and how to be a Vaishnava, how to serve and how to be a Vaishnava. So we are always trying to refine our understanding of Vaishnava Vyavahar, how to interrelate with the devotee. This is very important. We may chant our 16 rounds, follow the four principles, but we may not relate with other devotees in a mature way. This is a characteristic of Kanishtha Adhikari. We are trying to become a Madhyam Adhikari. Madhyam Adhikari means we are friendly with the other Vaishnavas. Kanishtha Adhikari is a little bit proud, a little bit separatist attitude sometimes. More easily they can fall into that, not necessarily, but generally. That they are proud, either of their being very pure. Sometimes even Prabhupada said that the pujaris, they used to become a little self-righteous and think that these devotees are coming in from Sankirtan with the dirty clothes and they're not, you know, sewed together and their vans are messy and this and that. And, you know, we're really together and pure and everything. And they start to, there's a little bit of a feeling in Prabhupada said, don't look at the Sankirtan devotees with that type of materialistic attitude. He warned, even in some purports it's mentioned, how he warned his pujaris that don't think just because you are worshipping the deity and you're very clean and pure in that way, that's your dharma. Those who worship the deities have to be very clean and pure. If they're not, it's an offense. But just the other people, they may not be physically or externally as clean because they're going out in the dust and the dirt and they're doing Sankirtan on the street. But their service is not less dear to the deity than the pujaris. Okay, they're giving their energy for spreading the Harinam Sankirtan. So like this, within this Vaishnava Vyavahar, it goes right into very essential concepts of pleasing Krishna. And so that one sees beyond the superficial. But sometimes we may get a little proud, or we may think, well, I'm chanting, you know, I'm doing my duty. Why is anybody saying anything to me? And we develop a little bit of a separatist attitude. The Krishna, Kapila Dev explains that whether through anger or ignorance or passion or goodness, we can have a separate attitude, but that is not pure devotion. Pure devotion has got no separatist attitude from Krishna. It's completely juicy. It's completely surrendered to Krishna. So even being a devotee, we have to see that whether within our devotion there's a mixture of passion, ignorance, or goodness. Ignorance means that sometimes in our devotion we get angry. Angry can be dovetailed in devotional service. That does not necessarily matter. But if our service is out of anger, I'm going to show them, I'm a better devotee. I'm not this type of like anger. It's not, rather than I just want to serve Krishna to please Guru and Krishna, I'm going to show them. It's devotion. He's doing service, but instead of being to please Krishna and Guru, it's to show them, I'm going to teach them, I'm better than the other or something like, I'm going to get back, but they're taking out, so it's dovetailed, but it's not pure. So therefore it doesn't completely satisfy, or someone is doing devotional service, but they're always bitter. My authorities, you never give me the break. I never get this. Always, you know, in some bitter attitude. This is all different aspects of mortal ignorance. Or then someone, they're doing devotional service, but they think, well, I got to work. I'm the devotee, but I got to get a good facility. I have to have a very comfortable life. I mean, beyond and above the call of duty, their primal objective is devotional service with comfort. Or to get heavenly planets, or some mystic power, or some kind of profit motive is there, labha. Or to get some kind of respect from others, but maybe not in an angry way, but in a more of a desirous way. This all under the mortal passion. This also is a separate, it's not pure just to please Guru and Krishna. So naturally, these things are there in our devotion. We can see these different thoughts Maya tries to introduce and tries to color. First, we have devotional sarva, pure desire, and then she tries to just like mix in a little tint, yellow, red, or blue, and tries to color it. We have to always be washing our laundry, so to speak, washing our consciousness in the pure nectar of Krishna consciousness of chanting and taking out all the little tints that Maya tries to introduce. Even why we do something is very important. This no one else can see outside. Everyone's doing the same thing. But internally, why we do something, we have to refine that. We have to analyze. When the mind is saying, yes, let us do this, this is the profit I'll get out of it. What? No. Don't think like that. Think in a Krishna conscious way. This is a Maya way of thinking. And the same activity can be done in pure devotion or can be done in good devotion or passionate devotion or ignorant devotion. These things were explained in the third canto. So why is Prahlad Maharaj totally satisfied? Because he has got Tibhraina Bhakti, is completely in pure devotion. His only desire is to please Guru and Krishna. He has no other desire. And to see other people be happy. So that's why when we hear about the pastimes of Prahlad, a little bit rubs off. And we should focus. What is the difference? Why is Prahlad so great? Because his attitude of devotion is so pure. His only desire is to, even he's offered all type of opulences, he's offered anything, but he never wavers in his complete conviction that he simply wants to serve the Guru. And he said, I'm not a businessman. When Nrsingadeva offered him, do you want mystic power? Do you want, he said, I'm not a businessman. I'm not serving you that I want liberation, I want something. I'm serving you for your satisfaction. I simply want you to be. I want to serve you eternally. Please give me more devotional service. A devotee, a pure devotee, doesn't serve with the idea that after I've served this much, then let me stop. I heard that when I was touring in South America, there was one devotee, a little bit in the mode of ignorance, and had left the movement or left a little bit. So he was trying to tell the newer people, trying to pollute, said, watch out, these gurus, they simply want to give you service. They always want to give you service. So I said, yeah, that's our job, is to give service. That's our service, is to give service. That is the service. Because by serving, that is the nectar. That is how we get purified. Always trying to give service. That is that, if everyone is being given service, then those people who are giving service, they're your friends. Whether they're the temple president or your kitchen head cook, whoever, the Sankirtan leader, we need service. The service is the only thing that keeps us away from Maya. If we're not doing service to Krishna, we are serving Maya. So Prahlad Maharaj is always serving Krishna, therefore he's always happy. But then he sees that these other people, they're suffering, just like Vasudeva Datta. He was happy in Krishna consciousness. He was totally in bliss with love of Krishna. But then he saw all the people in the material world, they're working hard trying to gratify their senses and they're suffering. So he went to Lord Chaitanya and he pleaded to him, Lord Chaitanya, please, somehow by your mercy I've got this nectar of Krishna consciousness. I'm always feeling Krishna conscious and happy. Why? All these people are suffering. Please, give all of their karma to me. Let me take on all of their sinful reactions. Let me suffer for them. Let them all go back to Krishna. Let them taste the nectar. Why better? Why one person can take all the karma? Why shouldn't one take all the karma and let them go? Why should so many suffer? Let me suffer for them and let them taste it. Because even if I'm suffering materially because I can chant your holy name, I'm going to feel blissful. But they have no hope for being blissful because they don't know about devotional service. So give them devotional service and let me take all the suffering for them. Let me rot in hell and let them go back to Krishna. Of course, Lord Chaitanya, he started crying when he heard this. How compassionate Vasudeva Datta is. He started to embrace Vasudeva Datta. Where in the history of the world is there anyone who has volunteered to take all of the karma of everyone, even they're not his followers? I mean, the demons, the devotees, the everyone. I mean, there are some great people, even who got sacrificed their life in various ways, and they said anyone who follows them will be delivered. But those who don't follow, they can rot in hell. They can burn in inferno. Inferno, yes. That's what I say in English. In the eternal fire. So, there's a contrast that we see here of Vasudev Datta. He was so merciful that when he gave his mercy, there was no condition. This is the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That even the most demonic person, even Nityananda, was struck by Jagai Madai. Just because you beat me on the head mean I won't give you praying? I won't give you love for Krishna just because you beat me? Chant Hare Krishna. And this is the mood of Vasudev Datta, Lord Nityananda, the mood of Lord Chaitanya's followers, to give this mercy somehow or another to everyone. Of course, we have so much mercy that Lord Chaitanya has like an ocean of it. And the people, you can hardly give them a drop. It's frustrating sometimes that people, you like to give them so much mercy, but they're so spiritually bankrupt that hardly you can give even a drop to them. If you give two drops, they'll overdose. So somehow or another, just by engaging them in a little service, letting them hear the holy name or giving them a little prasadam, they gradually, they build up. I met a person who is a devotee now, and he said, yes, he just became a new bhakta or bhakti, I forget who, but I remember he said that, yes, in 19 or something, like 10 years ago, on three occasions, I saw the Sankirtan party in New York, in Los Angeles, and in Miami. Fortunately, it wasn't in our zone, but he saw the Sankirtan, I even forget who it was, but he saw the Sankirtan in these three places, and now the person's come and surrendered. So even by seeing the Harinam, that can take its effect. After a period of time, they get delivered by getting a book, they read it. After years, there was one editor of a newspaper in India. He became a life member because someone, his relatives had become a life member. He had a book sitting on his bookshelf. He never read them. Never. He didn't care anything about Krishna consciousness, really. He just was publishing it. One day, the sky blew, just because every day he looked at the Bhagavatam sitting on his shelf. One day he just picked one out of the shelf and read it. Just opened it up and read it. A few pages. Immediately he was stunned. What is this book? And he started reading it, and he read it, you know, and then there he started immediately reading something like this, like Prahlad Maharaj, just some revolutionary statement that I am not afraid of material existence because my concern is for the fools and rascals who are making an elaborate plan. He just opened up and just, you know, read one of these revolutionary statements that we find in the Bhagavatam throughout it, and immediately, you know, after reading, he just couldn't stop, and he kept reading and reading, and then he looked up the devotees, and he just started chanting Hare Krishna. And everybody became amazed. Here this materialistic editor of an industrial magazine, he suddenly has become a fanatical Hare Krishna. You know, he's chanting all the time, he chants 16 rounds and everything, and he's a big Brahmin in India, he's from South India. So he says, yes, I know the Purusha Sukta and the Sahasranam, I mean, just know like mechanically. He says, but I never had any idea who is the absolute truth. Nobody ever told me. So Shiva or Brahma or whatever. But here it is so clear. It's Krishna is the absolute truth. He is the absolute. And so he's going and he's getting all the ministers to come. He's the editor of the newspaper, so all the ministers want him to publish good things about him. So he's very politically influential. And just because that book, somehow got the book on his shelf, he didn't even read it. After years, he said, I had the books for 3 years. I never read it once. When I read it, it changed my life. Now he's very enthusiastic. So of course that's, I mean, only in India, people buy a whole set of books and don't read it. But, is that it works in different ways. Krishna consciousness seeds we spread. And when they're going to fructify in this life or the next life, We never can say. But our job is simply to give out this mercy to every person, to every house, as much as we can. And eventually, it starts to take its effect. Even that present kind of religious revival in America is definitely due to Srila Prabhupada's preaching. It has changed the whole karma of America, the whole karma of the world. So we have to just become very dedicated instruments in Prabhupada's hand to the disciplic succession. We have to become empowered by Krishna. Each preacher, each Sankirtan devotee, each other devotee, they actually get empowered by Krishna. You know, we always read about how these Maharatis can fight against literally thousands and thousands of people. And then, you know, it's one of those things like Nama Parad, you don't want to tell people the glories, you don't want to tell people the glories of the Maharatis because it seems inconceivable how one person could fight against 10,000 people. It's just something is, all right, next page. But actually, they can do it because they're not having just human power. Of course, you know, this is another, for devotees we could understand it. But actually they do various tapasyas and they get certain type of supernatural powers to be able to fight. They get actual, like, power from Krishna, from different demigods and so on. They do tremendous tapasyas, these Maharatis. There's only, you know, in the whole battle there's a few dozen or so of them, Ratis and Maharatis and so on. But there are people who have done tremendous austerities and they get like blessings from great sages and gurus of that time who were very powerful. Even Arjuna got weapons from Indra and from different people from other planetary systems. So they have these extremely great powers. And of course, so that means, I mean, they're empowered, but maybe in a material sense they get the power. Where the preachers, we get our power from Krishna. Just like after the end of the Kurukshetra battle, Arjuna was going to get off the chariot, and Krishna told him, no, don't get off.
Why?
Just wait. Oh no, actually, Arjuna was saying, you know, to Krishna, you go off first. And Krishna said, no, no. You go off. So then Arjuna gets off, walks away. And what's going on, you know? And then Krishna, he gets off the chariot. As soon as Krishna steps off the chariot, it's like a nuclear explosion. The whole thing just disintegrates. Sparks and flames and smoke. Suddenly this huge, beautiful chariot which was given by, was it Indra or the Sangha? Who gave, someone gave him this. Varuna? Agni gave it. Agni gave it. Yes, it was given by Agni. It was just completely ashes. Nothing left of it. And Arjuna was spelled, what happened? And he said that so many people were throwing curses, secret weapons and all kind of things on me, that this chariot, if I wasn't standing on it, would have been disintegrated to ashes a long time ago. But because I was present, I was holding it off. So you have to leave. As soon as I left the chariot, it was finished. So it's like that. The devotee, sometimes people, they throw their different malefic, you know, desires against, but if a person just remains, like Prahlad was always a simple, surrendered devotee, no matter how much his father tried to destroy him, he couldn't be destroyed. Prahlad was never envious against his father. The anti-cult people think we're anti-fathers. No, the Prahlad was never envious against his father. This is his father happened to be a demon, was envious against his son. Actually, Prahlad was always the well-wisher of his father. The devotee loved his parents. It's a natural thing. And the parents, normally, the devotee parent, they love their children. So that's a natural thing. It's just Hiranyakashipu happened to be, you know, a demon. So in spite of his son loving him, and he hated his son. Because his son was a devotee, and not a demon like him. So, if we remain simple devotees, If we learn this, if somehow we get the blessing of Prabhupada and Prahlad, we can pray for that, that we can just always be fixed in devotion. We get empowered, we can preach. And even though there may be so many obstacles, somehow Krishna protects the devotee. Even though we're put in different difficulties, somehow, and when you're preaching in the West, there's always some difficulty come. I was personally thrown in jail when I was preaching in Montreal. But somehow the chief of police was my friend because I had somehow had good relations with him. So then when he found I was in jail, he got me taken out. But when you're preaching, there's always a certain risk that one takes. But wherever we are, whether we're in jail or whether we're outside or whatever, we shouldn't be puffed up and think, I'm a devotee, therefore Krishna. But we should try, rather, to please Krishna. Try to avoid, of course, offending people, but try to please Krishna. And by Krishna's own mercy, with not that out of pride, we should, do things which are rash, thinking that Krishna will protect us. That's another perversion. But rather, just by being surrendered to Krishna and trying, one can experience how Krishna does help the devotee. That comes causelessly, causeless mercy, confirmed. But he'll sneeze. So, in this way, instead of being absorbed in other things, the preacher should be absorbed like Prahlad. That if I engage these people in service, I'm helping them, even though superficially they're demons. And of course, Hiranyakashipu was a demon. He was killed by or delivered by Narasimhadev. But Lord Chaitanya, his mood is even these demons, if we engage him in service, then eventually their demoniac aspect is killed, but what's left is their devotional aspect. So they become devotees. So our mood is that we try to engage the people in service, and by this they'll benefit. We are doing them a service. But in reciprocation, we like to give something as far as possible back. We like to give them as much spiritual knowledge as they could accept. Directly or indirectly, we try to engage, but knowingly or unknowingly, they benefit. And this is our objective, is we try to benefit the whole society. We're here not simply for ourselves, but we're here for helping the entire society to become Krishna conscious. This is our ultimate objective. But it's a voluntary option. We simply provide, and we want to improve the facilities so we can provide a more attractive option for them. So it's more hard for them to refuse. But our objective is eventually to give everyone this positive alternative of Krishna consciousness so that they can become Krishna conscious and they can become freed from the suffering of the material world, that they can also experience the same bliss of Krishna consciousness that Prahlad Maharaj has handed down to us through Srila Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Nitai Guru Premanandi. Any questions? Pablo?
I wonder what is more important for a Vaishnava, to remain in brahmachari or to be
Well, it's more important. It's an individual situation. Individual. That Prabhupada explains in the 8th canto of Bhagavatam that we have to work from whatever our position of strength is. The example was that the elephant was fighting against the crocodile. But the crocodile and elephant were in the water. So the elephant was becoming weaker and the crocodile was becoming stronger. So the elephant was gradually not able to fight. So he started to pray for Krishna to help. So in this verse, Prabhupada explains that the devotee should be physically, mentally, and spiritually strong. And it tends to be a little bit of an energy drain. In other words, for them, the mind is being distracted a lot by different thoughts like that. So it's a constant thing that a person has to work at. Of course, everyone can do it, but it just seems to be like an energy drain. Or possibly one would be more peaceful and productive
in a family situation. So basically, it depends upon each individual. Generally, our program is that people should first of all practice the Brahmacharya life as far as possible and become strong. And then after some time, then the spiritual master and senior Vaishnavas, they can help to advise one whether they should enter into the Grihastha ashram or whether they should try to remain in the Brahmacharya ashram for some more time, or in some cases, rarely, if someone should take sannyas.